So thank you very much. Welcome to the press briefing of the Information Service in Geneva here at the UN. Today is Tuesday, 14th of January. We have quite a few announcements and a couple of topics, and I'll start immediately with Kennedy for IOM, who's going to brief us on Haiti. Just as a reminder, the 12th of January, so on Sunday, we marked 15 years since the devastating earthquake that claimed the lives of hundreds of thousands of people in Haiti. The Secretary General remembered the victims of the earthquake and continued to honor their legacy through the United Nations work in the country. He also paid tribute to the 102 colleagues, our own colleagues, who died on that day, including the head of the mission at that time and a number of others. There were about 3 million people who were estimated to be impacted by the earthquake, and the destructions of the earthquake are still having presenting challenges for Haiti. So, and as we all know, the situation of security and humanitarian situation are worsening in the country, and that is what we will hear now from Kennedy. You have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just to start us off, that we have seen an increase in the number of displacement in Haiti since the violence surged last year. As you can recall, in December 2023, we did record around 315,000 people who were displaced from the violence. One year since then, we have seen the number tripled to over 1 million people who have now been displaced because of gang violence in Haiti. This is a really troubling number, and it represents the security situation that most Haitians are currently facing. The most concrete data we have is that around 1,041,000 people, to be precise, are currently living in displacement in Haiti. Most of these people have been displaced multiple times. We have seen a lot of the displacement occurring within the capital of Port-au-Prince, but then we have seen also a lot of people being displaced and moving towards the neighboring provinces. And this also has created a bit of pressure on the social services within the provinces that are adjacent to Haiti. And now we are seeing more and more people moving and seeking refuge, living with families, communities, friends, and who already are facing their own economic challenges, further putting a strain and creating a lot of a struggle for most of the community members. Humanitarian access to basic services like food, water, clean water, and shelter is becoming more and more limited to most of those displaced, emphasizing the need for sustained humanitarian aid and access to those who have been displaced in Haiti itself. We have seen also, as I did mention, the spread of the violence beyond the capital, and this means more and more people are also being displaced, even within the neighboring provinces. What has really made this worse is the fact that we have seen over and over deportations still occurring back to Haiti, where our communities are already struggling to basically survive. Just last year alone, 200,000 people were returned to Haiti amidst the current security situation and the dire humanitarian needs that the country is facing. Just to add up on that, we've seen that the displacement sites within the capital city, Port-au-Prince, have surged just within this 1 year. In the beginning of the year, we did record around 73 displacement camps within the capital, but now the camps have grown to 108 camps within 1 year, re-emphasizing the surge in displacement within the province alone. Reports indicate that even within these sites, we are seeing more and more deteriorating conditions, with families struggling to survive in makeshift shelters amidst mounting health and protection risks. Despite the challenges, IOM, of course, and other UN organizations have been providing critical support to those in need. So far, we have been able to provide around 18 million liters of water to communities, clean water to communities in displacement, rehabilitated water pumps, and provided additional support to 75,000 people, including support on medical assistance, rental subsidies, and relocation assistance for those in need. The challenge that still stands is the access remains one of the biggest challenge. We need, as the violence surges, it becomes more and more difficult to access those who basically need the humanitarian's aid more and more. These efforts are essential, of course. We reiterate the need for humanitarian assistance and also long-term investments in governance, security, and social cohesion, simply to ensure that we have to break the silence of the cycle of violence and displacement and foster stability in communities towards restoring hope, recovery to the people of Haiti. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kennedy. And just to remind the journalists that we call for the international community to show solidarity with the Haitian people and contribute to funding appeals. As of today, the humanitarian needs response plan, which was asking for $674 million, is only 42% funded. We have a gap of $87.7 million. Without this funding, of course, the 3.6 million people targeted by the plan will face severely reduced chances of survival. And I'll open now the floor to questions in the room. Jamie, good morning. Happy New Year. I think we see you for the first time.
Good morning, Alessandra. Thank you, Kennedy. Good morning to you and Happy New Year. You mentioned that there were 200,000 people who returned to Haiti last year. Where did those people come from primarily? Where were they returned from? And what are you expecting in terms of trends for this year? Do you think that that number will rise this year?
Thank you, Jamie. A lot of the deportations that were recorded last year were basically seen from the Dominican Republic. And in terms of projection, we cannot say as long as these policies stay in place, then the number of people who are going to arrive back in Haiti is going to increase. But what we are really calling for is to make sure that we do not really deport people to situations where they are not going, situations that are not favorable to them. Just a word that, you know, it's important to note that at the moment Haiti is facing the largest number of internal displacement as a result of the gang violence ever in history. So additional returns only add to this number and straining the social services that are already beyond stretch at this moment. Thanks.
Sorry, Maya.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. My question is regarding the number of displacement camps. You mentioned 73, but the sites have increased. And how many of these camps are run by IOM or the UN refugees? Do you have this number?
I can confirm the number to you, but at the moment we are offering support to most of these camps. These are not camps that are established entirely by IOM, but we're having makeshift shelters where people are trying to seek refuge even as the violence surges. So I can get back to you on the specific number of camps that are being controlled by IOM and this stuff. Thanks.
I'll go to the platform if there are no other questions in the room. Lisa Schlein.
Good morning. Thank you, Alessandra. Yes, I'd like to continue to ask you a bit about the deportations. What are your concerns regarding the new Trump administration, which has threatened to deport immigrants, not just from Haiti, but from all over, and has not looked favorably on the Haitians in particular. As you recall, in during the election, there was a lot of scandal regarding Haitians who were living in Ohio. And are you concerned also that the United States might cancel or do away with the temporary humanitarian asylum policy, which has or is protecting the Haitians and other immigrants from countries where their lives might be at risk? That's one question. And then would you say that Haiti at this point is in a situation of total anarchy and that there is no effective police, either domestic or international security force, which is able to do something in order to get rid of these Haitian gangs and create some kind of order and protection for the people? Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Just to start you off from the last question, we are aware of the efforts made by the multilateral forces that are working towards restoring peace in Haiti. The progress is, we cannot speak much towards the progress, but what we do know that the number of people who are being displaced, you know, is a clear indication of the surge of violence. So as much as we basically need more support towards these multilateral forces to ensure that we have peace and stability to the country, to the country and to the Haitians who desperately need this. In terms of the deportations, I'll not speak specifically to countries' policies and preempt, but I think it is important to note that, deportations or any forced returns to countries that are already facing mounting security and humanitarian challenges is not something that it's going to be beneficial to the group as well, because we have seen more and more stretch in social services. We have seen more and more stretch to the risk to the people themselves. Just last week, I think OACHR did release a report outlining the number of deaths that have been recorded so far. This basically, re-emphasizes the need for, protection of lives. And so returning people to such situation is not something that is going to be beneficial to both their security and their livelihoods.
And maybe just to add, Lisa, as you know, we welcome, the Secretary General welcomed the Security Council press statements of the 23rd of December, which stressed the need for the international community to double their efforts to support the national police and strengthen the multilateral security support mission. You have to consider that so far around 750 personnel has been deployed from Bahamas, Belize, El Salvador, Guatemala, Jamaica, and of course Kenya, who is in the lead. And Kenya has indicated that it intends to deploy an additional 600 police officers, but this is out of 2,500 personnel initially planned. So we really need to step this up in order to for the mission to demonstrate its full potential, really. And the Secretary General has been appealing to the international community to ensure that the MSS mission receives the financial and logistical supports it needs to succeed. As you know, we've also established the trust fund to support it, and the SG has encouraged the member states and other entities to contribute to the trust fund, which is currently severely underfunded. I see Lisa has a follow-up.
Yes, very quickly. How many Haitians have been deported from the Dominican Republic? If you already mentioned it, it went by me. Thank you.
I can give you the specific numbers, but the total number of Haitians that have been deported, recorded by IOM so far, stands at around 200,000 just in 2024 alone.
Thank you. Just to note that the numbers of the deployments I gave you was up to the 9th of January. Gabriela, is this a question on Haiti? Or just go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, Alessandra. Happy New Year. Yes, it's on Haiti. I am not aware of all the details, but this mission that went from other countries to strengthen the police, but is there any possibility to send blue helmets or something like that? Or is a different thing? Or what can the UN do to strengthen the security there?
Look, as you know, the decision about peacekeeping forces is entirely up to the Security Council, to member states, and this MSS is not a UN operation. But of course, you know, beyond who is in charge of this or that, I think we can say that the UN is fully committed to seeing succeed the MSS, but also, of course, the work of that the UN and humanitarian organization are carrying out in Haiti. So we are present, we are there, and we support fully the mission of the MSS. Obviously, if there had to be another decision, that would be up to the member states. Any other question on Venezuela? Oh, sorry, we said Venezuela, on Haiti. I don't see any. Okay. So thank you very much, Kennedy. I think we have established the connection with Ricardo. James, you come on the podium. Thank you very much, Kennedy. So welcome, James. Happy New Year to you. And happy New Year to Ricardo. Ricardo Pires, who's joining us from Damascus. Ricardo is Communication Manager for Emergencies for UNICEF. Maybe you want to start and then we give him the floor? Or
thanks so much. Bonne année. Hi, everyone. Nice to be back. Alessandra, thank you. Yes, tech, IT, nothing like it in what we call a level 3 emergency. Ricardo's been in Damascus and in the field in Homs and is now going to brief on UXOs and the ongoing threat to children despite some good news in the last month or two. Ricardo.
Thanks, James. Bonjour à tous. Good morning. Thanks for having me here. As hopes for peace dividend for Syrian children grow, girls and boys in the country continue to suffer the brutal impact of unexploded ordnances, or UXOs, at an alarming rate. In December last year alone, at least 422,000 incidents involving UXOs were reported in 14 governorates across the country. In December last year alone as well, 116 children were killed or injured by UXO, an average of nearly 4 per day. This is believed to be an underestimated given the fluidity of the situation, the humanitarian situation on the ground. Actually, over the past 9 years, there was a bit of a confusion. Over the past 9 years, at least 422,000 incidents involving UXOs were reported in 14 governorates across Syria, with half estimated to have ended in tragic child casualties. Across Syria, children face this lurking, often invisible, but extremely deadly threat. Renewed displacement only worsens the danger. Since 27 November, at least over 250,000 children were forced to flee their homes due to renewed and escalating conflict. For these children and those who are trying to return to their original areas, the peril of UXOs is constant and unavoidable. As reconstruction efforts continue to be discussed and the international community prepares to help Syria pave a new path for children, it is imperative that immediate investment takes place to ensure the ground is safe and clear of explosives. Over a decade of devastating conflict has left communities across Syria littered with deadly remnants of war, including an estimated 320,000 pieces of unexploded ordnances scattered across the country. This danger affects approximately 5 million children who are living in high-risk areas contaminated with UXO and landmines, which have become the leading cause of child casualties in Syria Every step they take carries the risk of an unimaginable tragedy. One of them happened to 12-year-old Abdul, who I met in the outskirts of Hama yesterday. On 18th December, he was playing football with friends in a field behind his house when one of them stepped on something shiny on the ground. What followed was a blast that killed 15-year-old Mohammed, Abdul's cousin, and injured Abdul and his younger brother, 10-year-old Mohammed, who are now recovering from multiple fractures in their legs and arms. They can no longer walk without help. Both are deeply traumatized. Their stories are far too common. Abdul's mother cried when trying to recount the trauma and mentioned that yesterday, another 3 children died after bringing a grenade into their homes, which they found on a playground without knowing of the deadly impact it could have. Even if children survive these blasts, the struggle doesn't end. Life-changing injuries and disabilities often mean they cannot return to school or might find it harder to access proper healthcare. They face a new kind of war against isolation, stigma, and limited opportunity. But these are things we can do today to life. But there are things we can do today to make life just a little more bearable for these children. We must push for increased humanitarian demining efforts to remove the deadly remnants of war and make communities safe again. We need to expand mine risk education so children can recognize and avoid UXO. And we must provide comprehensive support for survivors, including medical care, rehabilitation, and psychological services, so they can regain their dignity and rebuild their lives. We owe it to these children, not just to listen, but to act. There is no hope for reconstruction in Syria when there is so much destruction still lying in wait on the ground. Syria cannot move past this horrific war if children remain at risk outside their doors and being blown up by explosives. Every day without action is another day that threatens the children of Syria. These children who have lived their entire lives in danger deserve to live the rest of their lives in safety. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry, thank you very much, Ricardo. Let me open the floor to questions. I'll start with Jeremy Lange, Radio France Internationale.
Thank you so much, Ricardo. 2 questions, maybe. Which places are most concerned today in Syria by UXO? Are we talking about the Idlib area? Is it more the east? Can we find those UXOs in Damascus, in the outskirts of Damascus as well? So places. And the second question will be about the demining efforts. Are there any demining efforts today in Syria? Do you have vehicles on the ground trying to demine a few places, or all those completely absent today?
Thank you. So your first question in terms of the scale of the threat, it's really across Syria, but the areas in Aleppo, Homs, where I was yesterday, in Hama, but also, as you mentioned, Idlib, even though access to that area had been very restricted over the course of the war. But I would say the 2 main areas that are at risk are Aleppo, Homs, and rural Damascus, where you can definitely find many UXO and mines that are threatening the lives of children every day. In terms of the mining efforts, look, for UNICEF, really our role is to advocate for these efforts to take place. They haven't been happening fast enough over the last 14 years, and we hope that the situation will change now. We are trying to really raise awareness and educate children and communities and families about the risks of these devices, so horrible events like the ones I described don't happen again. But in terms of more comprehensive demining efforts, this is really up to the new authorities to look into it, because mines are normally addressed by government. So it's what we call the white helmets that look at the UXO. And again, in the last 14 years since the civil war started, these efforts were not broad enough or even encouraged. So there is a lot of work to do, and UNICEF will be doing our part and continuously so these threats reduce day after day.
Other questions in the room? Let me go to the platform. Nick Cumming-Bruce, New York Times.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to ask, given that conflict continues, do you have any indication that mines continue to be being laid? And if so, by which parties? And secondly, there are several humanitarian demining organizations operating in Syria. Do you see any sign of this coming on the agenda of the interim government? And is there any move to establish coordination between them? Thank you.
Definitely something that we are heavily advocating for. It's one of the main advocacy asks that we have at the moment. It's the main cause of child casualties in Syria right now, and has been for many years, and will continue to be, because the ground continues to be infested and contaminated. Over 300,000 mines are still spread across the country. In some areas it's more concentrated, but the threat is everywhere, as we've heard with the story of Abdul and his cousin, who were playing just literally outside their homes. And I went to the area. It doesn't look like an area that had heavy military action. In terms of new mines being placed, I don't know. I haven't heard anything about it. But for sure, since 8th of December, when the previous government fell, a lot of weapons have been left behind, a lot of explosive weapons or just weapons in general, in many areas, including in homes where I was, but also in Damascus. So there is a lot of work to do. The mines and the UXOs are there more than ever because of what happened since 8th of December. So indeed, there are efforts to change it, but it doesn't seem like it's happening fast enough. The situation on the ground since I arrived anyways is very fluid. There's still a lot of celebratory atmosphere across Damascus especially, but this is not being talked with the urgency to look into these issues and the humanitarian situation for children in Syria, which continues to be very, very dire, with at least 7.5 million children in urgent need of humanitarian needs and humanitarian support. So a lot of work needs to be done, and it needs to be done faster.
So go ahead.
Nick, excuse me, Nick, just to add, as you rightly say, other organisations like Halo Trust and so on the ground, and I'm not sure if you've seen, but when we talk in a place like Syria with the density and the sheer number of mines, excuse me, that Ricardo refers to, we're talking about tens of millions of dollars, not hundreds of millions of dollars. We're talking about tens of millions of dollars for the demining, for that removal of those explosive ordnance, well, disposal of those explosive ordnances. So we're talking tens of millions of dollars, which, as we've just heard, would save thousands of lives and will be an absolutely imperative part if Syria is to, again, become a middle-income country. So if you're talking about tens of millions of dollars as a major influence to help Syria regain that status it had as a middle-income country, then it is a very cheap price that needs to be paid.
Indeed. Other questions on Syria? I don't see any other hand up. Ricardo, thank you very much for being with us this morning, and please continue updating us here in Geneva. Good luck with your important work there. Thank you very much, James. I would like now to move to Ukraine. Babar, I think you are online. Yes, you are. I understand you are in Geneva, right? Yeah. Okay.
I am. Yes. Good morning.
Yeah. Okay. Good morning. So, just an announcement. to let you know that the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs and the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, the Refugee Agency, in collaboration with the government of Ukraine and humanitarian partners, will jointly launch the 2025 Humanitarian Needs and Response Plan and the Regional Refugee Response Plan for Ukraine on the 16th of January from Kyiv. These plans are aiming to ensure the continuation of critical assistance for people affected by the humanitarian crisis in Ukraine, which is about 12.7 million people who require aid, and for the more than 6.8 million Ukrainian refugees worldwide. So we will have the launch on the 16th. Immediately before the launch, there will be a press conference with USG Tom Fletcher, as you know, the USG for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, and Filippo Grandi, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, in Kyiv. That will be at 2 p.m. the local time, and in a center in Kyiv. So journalists in Kyiv are invited to attend the press conference. We will send you the information if it's not already done. I think Vanessa may have sent it already out. And of course, it's there, but it will be webcast by our colleague of UNTV Geneva. There will be the launch event at 3 p.m. Local time. Also webcast, webcast live streamed on UN Web TV. What you can do, if you want to ask questions, you can send them to Vanessa beforehand, and they will be transmitted to the two USGs. That will have to be done before 8 a.m. GMT on the 16th of January. So basically, questions to Vanessa as soon as possible, and then the press conference and the launch on UN Web TV. And maybe, Babar, you want to say a little bit more on the refugee response plan that you will be announcing there.
Yeah, apologies. Good morning, dears. Happy New Year and a happy Tuesday. Indeed, so all the details will be shared in an embargoed press release, hopefully tomorrow. So all of you have it in advance with all the details, both the humanitarian response plan for inside Ukraine and also for the refugee response plan for the region. All the details will be in it with all the numbers and updated figures as well, and what we are asking in that sense. Once you receive it, please be in touch, as it was mentioned. The launch is in Kyiv, and also before the launch, the press conference. So hopefully you can follow the proceedings online, and please share questions in case you have. Our dear Jens is on the ground, and he will be moderating the press conference on Thursday. Back to you, Alessandra.
Thank you very much. Yes, indeed. And Vanessa is in Geneva, so don't hesitate to ask. Any question on this launch of the two appeals? I don't see any hand up. Yes, Gabriela.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. It's on another subject, if it's possible to ask.
Yeah, I think you can go ahead because I don't see questions on Ukraine. So just go ahead. Is it for Babar?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So I'm asking on Venezuela that if you are vigilant, because now that Maduro is the new president, there's going to be a lot of people that is going to be out of Venezuela, because they are the opposition and everything, and all these people are going to be, very harassed by the government. So people has to leave. So I don't know if you have in mind any plan, any contingency plan for people that is going to leave Venezuela, because there's already 7 million or something like that had left the country. So what is your opinion on that? If you have any plan, any estimate of how many people is going to leave Venezuela?
Sure. Thank you, dear Gabriela. Indeed, I mean, as you mentioned, 7 million people are already outside of Venezuela. I can check in terms of what the update we have from our side. I have nothing this morning, but I can follow up with my colleagues and then we can get back to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Babar. Any other question? Either yes, Emma?
Hi, Babar. I actually had one on Ukraine. Since we're coming up to the 3-year anniversary, there are some signs, including in Switzerland, that conditions for giving Ukrainian refugees asylum here are tightening, getting tougher. Could you comment on the trend across Europe? Are you seeing Europe, some European countries, start to turn their backs on Ukrainians? And are you concerned about this going forward? Thank you.
Thank you, Emma. Nothing in terms of updates for now. I think what you will hear through the launch on Thursday is this is not the time to turn our back on Ukraine or on people who have left Ukraine. So this is the launch is actually an attempt in that way to kind of ensure the continuation of critical assistance for people who are affected by the humanitarian crisis in Ukraine. I mean, we're talking about over 12.7 million people who require aid, and also there are more than 6.8 million Ukrainian refugees worldwide. But I can follow up in terms of specifically what you were asking, and then we can get back to you.
Thank you very much. I don't see other hands up. So thank you very much, Babar. Good luck with the launch and hope you will be following it in great numbers. I have quite a few other announcements for you. Let me start with OHCHR. So I'm asked to announce you that the first World Congress on Enforced Disappearances will take place from 15 to 16th of January here in Geneva. The event will feature panel discussions on topics such as international responsibility for the forcibly disappeared, strengthening search procedures, and protecting victims, rights defenders, lawyers, and journalists. The event is co-organized by the UN Committee on Enforced Disappearances, the UN Working Group on Enforced or Involuntary Disappearances, the UN Human Rights Office, and the Convention Against Enforced Disappearances Initiative. It will be held at the Geneva International Conference Center. It will be open to the press and to the public, and you can register on site if you wish. Also on the committees, as I think Michele reminded you last Friday, the Committee on the Rights of the Child started his work and is concluding this morning the review of the report of Slovakia. The other countries to be reviewed are Eritrea, Honduras, San Kitts and Nevis, Peru, Gambia, and Ecuador. I also wanted to announce you two other events this week. Also on the 16, 17 of January, so this Thursday and Friday, in room 5 of the Palais, our office, UNOG, is organizing, together with the Nizami Ganjavi International Center, a high-level meeting entitled From Promise to Impact, Implementing the Pact for the Future and COP29 Commitments. This event will serve as a platform to discuss how key commitments from the Pact of the Future and from COP29 can be transformed into tangible and actionable strategies. The meeting will bring together an assembly of prominent figures, including former heads of state, leaders of international organizations, and these include not only our Director General, Tatiana Valovaya, but also Dr. Tedros, Doreen Bogdan-Martin, Winnie Brahima, and others. You have the full list of speakers on the internet. The event is open to journalists, so don't hesitate to participate if you wish. And then lastly, I wanted to announce you also that on the 17th of January, the permanent mission of Italy, the permanent mission of the Holy See, UNHCR, and of course, as a cultural activity, UNOG, we'll host the first screening in Switzerland of the film Cabrini, This is a movie dedicated to the figure of Mother Francesca Cabrini, foundress of the religious congregation, the missionary sister of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. Mother Francesca devoted herself to assisting Italian migrants in the U.S. at the beginning of the last century, and as such she was proclaimed saint. So the idea of this event is for UNHCR and the DG of UNOG, who will participate together with other dignitaries of the mission, to underline the importance of the support to migrants and refugees. And there will be the main actress of the movie, Cristiana Dell'Anna, who will do the trip to Geneva to talk at the panel which will precede the screening. So that is what I had on my list of events. Let me see. I think that's about it for what I wanted to tell you. Just a reminder that tomorrow at 10 a.m. New York time, the Secretary General will be presenting its priorities for 2025 to the General Assembly. Of course, this will be webcast, so you're invited to listen to it. We will distribute, of course, the statement afterwards. And there had to be, maybe you have heard, that there had to be a press conference on the Thursday on the priority of the Secretary General, but this has been postponed. We will announce the new time as soon as possible, but there should be a press briefing just after the presentation of the priorities, a shorter press briefing by the Secretary General. We will confirm this in writing to you as soon as possible. Emma.
I was hoping to ask a question to Jennifer and to Christian.
Jennifer is here. Maybe you want to come to the to the podium? Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I was just hoping to get an update on Peterson's whereabouts and plans now. I'm also curious if he's met the new Middle East envoy of the U.S., Steve Witkoff. And what are the chances of Geneva talks? We heard about this as a possibility in December. Where are we now? Thank you.
So Mr. Peterson has returned to Geneva this morning. I think you'll have seen over the weekend, he was in Riyadh. There he welcomed the strong support expressed for the Syrian people and the commitment to assisting the caretaker authorities during this critical time. He noted that he had a constructive meeting with Syria's caretaker foreign minister, al-Shabani, which focused on advancing an inclusive Syrian-led political transition and addressing the challenges and opportunities in a post-Assad Syria. The discussions in Saudi, you will have seen, underscored the importance again of the credible, inclusive transition, which of course has to be led by the Syrians, but backed by genuine international support to help the Syrians navigate this transition. Of course, Mr. Peterson reiterated the UN's readiness to assist Syria and its people in seizing this opportunity and addressing any challenges. Mr. Peterson had noted his desire to visit Syria as soon as feasibly possible again. The Deputy Special Envoy, Ms. Najat Rushdie, remains in Damascus, where she continues her engagements. If I have any information regarding those, I will make sure to get those to you. Mr. Peterson has briefed the Security Council three times since this transition took place in December. I don't have a date for the next Security Council briefing, but I think another one will be scheduled this month, which has been communicated, I think, by the presidency of the Council regarding talks in Geneva. I don't have anything further at this time.
And just the Trump's new envoy for the Middle East, have they met?
I do not believe so, but I note that the U.S., I believe, was part of the discussions in Riyadh. If I have any further information, I'll get that to you.
Thank you, Jennifer. Gabriela, is that for Jennifer too?
No, Alessandra, it's really for you.
Okay, let me see if there are other further questions. Yeah, Jamie, for Jennifer.
Good morning. Hello, Jennifer. Happy New Year. Could you just remind us what Mr. Peterson's view is about the future of the Security Council resolution? whose number is now escaping me all of a sudden. 2254, thank you. Could you just tell us what his status is on that, please, his position on that is?
He did brief the council on that last week, and he noted that obviously Resolution 2254 cannot be applied in the literal manner as it was adopted in 2015, and there have been significant changes since then. For instance, he noted to the council that former regime members will not be a party to enter any future process. Of course, there are other examples too, but he noted that there is wide consensus. The transition still does need to achieve the main things that Resolution 2254 lays out. So first, a credible, inclusive, and transparent Syrian-led and owned transition. And on this, he was very clear that he does not believe that any Syrian is asking for quotas based on sex, ethnicity, or importing models, for example, from other countries, but rather that we need to see the broadest spectrum of Syrian civil society and Syrian parties represented. So that's in part to inspire public confidence in any transition moving forward. Second, he's noted, of course, ensuring a credible, inclusive, and transitional government. Third, a new constitution needs to be prepared that is credible and, again, inclusive process. And fourth, we need to see fair and free elections that are inclusive of all Syrians and in accordance with international standards. Those are all main points of Resolution 2254 that Mr. Pedersen has communicated he believes remains relevant.
Go ahead. I could just follow up on that. Thank you. Over the course of the three meetings that you mentioned that he's already had with the since the transition, is I think the word you used, the transition last month, is there any sort of sign, just either in his formal briefings or communications with members of the Security Council, that could lead to his belief that maybe there's an effort underway afoot to actually find an alternative to 2254? Is there any steps forward in that direction, as far as you can tell?
So, yes, he has briefed the council three times. I don't have anything further than what I just communicated to you. You will have seen the council put out their own statement, which I believe was December 17th or thereabout. So I would defer you to the council members.
Mr. Liang.
Hello, Jennifer. Yeah, this is me from China Economic Daily. My question is about whether you have any comment on the latest revelation of that fact that the Syrian transitional government is making some appointment of to its top government leadership positions of some jihadist individuals, whether you could call that foreign militant groups. Last week, China's envoy in the Security Council mentioned the involvement of ETIM members. But I don't want to specify on that particular group, because this is exactly the same question that was raised by some of my peer colleagues last week. So are you aware of the appointment by the Syrian transitional government of those foreign militant individuals in their top echelon, like what the Taliban is doing in Afghanistan?
So again, I think Mr. Pedersen addressed this in his Security Council briefing last month, so I can send you that link if you need it again. I will just reiterate what I said, that Mr. Pedersen had noted any transition needs to be fully inclusive of all Syrians, and that any persons taking part in any transition and governance moving forward, they need to comply fully with international law and behave in accordance with international standards.
Thank you very much. I don't see other hands up for you. Jen, thank you very much for coming to the podium. Gabriela, you had a question for me.
Yes, thank you. Actually, one quick clarification or a question. If there's going to be any press encounter with Carla Quintana, the one that is in charge of disappearances in Syria, I don't know if you have contemplating that. I'm asking not before because I am Mexican, but it's because disappearances are very important issue in Syria. So I don't know if you are planning something like that. And second question, if there's going to be any press conference with the committee and everybody that is going to be in the disappearances conference. Is there any encounter that you are planning with the press? Thank you.
This, you refer to the World Congress? The second part of your question. I think it, that's
yes.
what, yeah, okay.
Yes, yes,
so,
yes.
okay, so on Syria, obviously determining the fate of missing person is critical, and the UN pledges its support to those who continue to live with the agony of uncertainty. And as you refer to, we have Mrs. Quintana now leading the independent institution on missing person in Syria. As you had already asked, I spoke to Nemrin, the new focal point for communication of Mrs. Quintana. She took note of your request. She told me that she will look into organizing some kind of press encounter with Mrs. Quintana, and we will inform you of it as soon as possible. As for the World Congress, I don't know. We will have to ask the colleagues of OHCHR. I'll do it with pleasure, and I'm pretty sure they will let you know if there is any media encounter. What I know is that the meeting at the CSCG is open to the press, so you can definitely go there, and there will be colleagues who can facilitate contacts. But as for a press conference, I will have to ask them. Yes, Emma.
Is Christian still online? Could I ask a question?
I think he is. Christian, your patience has paid. You have a question. Emma, go ahead.
Hi, Christian. I wanted to ask about Tedros's visit to Washington. I saw he was there for Jimmy Carter's funeral. At this key moment in American history with the transition, did he also take the opportunity to meet some of the incoming administration? Can you give any details if he did? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Emma. Good question, interesting question, but unfortunately, I have no further details on that one. We'll check and let you know in case.
Any other question for WHO? Since we've got Christian on the line. Gabriela.
Thank you, Alessandra. Hi, Christian. Happy New Year. My question is, if you issue any statement or any recommendations for the people who are living around Los Angeles area, there's still going on the fire and there's a lot of smoke. So I don't know if you have any recommendations for the people that are living around the area. Thank you.
Look, I think we had that topic last week already, if I recall right. I mean, obviously, smoke inhalation can be really toxic, and the fumes that together with the dust and the ashes and everything. So the respiratory troubles can be a lot when you inhale this. But of course, it's something difficult to avoid when you're living in the area right now. Caring for your life, I think, is the most important one. Following the evacuation orders and so on and so forth. But for those further away, take care of your respiratory systems, obviously, whether that is closing windows, trying to avoid being outside when there's the fumes around, however that is possible during everyday life, of course.
Thank you very much. Any other question for Christian? I don't see any, so thank you very much. I think this concludes our briefing. I've given you all the announcements I had. We'll follow up with the office of Mrs. Quintana. And thank you very much. And I'll see you on Friday. Thank you.